This paid podcast is produced by Slate Studios and Teva Pharmaceuticals.
From Slate Studios and Teva Pharmaceuticals, this is Life Effects, a podcast about health. I'm your host, Sarah Avery. In this season, we explore health conditions and trends through the lens of the patient. We look at what they experience now.
Tracking my pulmonary function test was important because when I get ready to go to the doctor every 3 months and have those done, I get such anxiety.
And we bring researchers into the conversation who can map out for us what the future might hold.
So we can use a combination of things like telehealth and wearable technology and AI that actually change the paradigm of our traditional health system so that we can really be tracking everybody every minute of every day.
Today, we're talking tech. From pacemakers to big data to apps that monitor everything from your oxygen to your sugar levels, technology in all its different forms is increasingly helping people manage their healthcare and prolong their lives. Glenda Rowland has personally benefited from tech. She shares her story with us.
We took a family trip and we went to Florida. And when we got there and I stepped out in the humidity the first day, I could not breathe. I could not walk very far. I was having trouble getting a deep breath. And that was the first symptom that I had. I had gone to a pulmonologist. They said that one of the tests was questionable and that they needed to do a CT scan. And a week later, I received a call at work. I was told that I had IPF, or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Pulmonary fibrosis is a group of diseases that cause scarring to the lungs, which result in a reduction in oxygen to your brain, really all of your organs. Idiopathic, which means unknown cause, is the worst kind you can have, and the life expectancy is 3 to 5 years. There's no cure. There's nothing they can do. I just, tried to find out all I could about it. I learned from other people. I found some sites where I could go on and talk to people that had the specific disease that I had. And then I started doing some investigating, and I realized that being short of breath is not always a symptom that your oxygen can be low. The only way you can know that is to have something that's checking them. And I have an app on my phone. I can always put my finger under the light that takes the pictures for the camera, and it will check my oxygen saturation. The other app I use, it's a handheld spirometer that connects by Bluetooth. So I can check the forced volume capacity, which is a pulmonary test, on my own every day. And it keeps track of it on there too. I have one that I put on my wrist and I stick my finger in a little, it looks like a little pillow, and it can track my oxygen saturation while I'm sleeping. During the night, your oxygen naturally goes lower. And then the next day I can put it into my computer and I can see exactly what time of night my oxygen went below what it should be, or if it did at all, and I could let my doctor know. I like to keep track of everything, and I like to see where my trend is going. I keep all of my information, my lab test results, my pulmonary function test results, my symptoms. It's all in the cloud. I can go back and I can look at my information. So all of these things I feel like help me to stay on top of, you know, my daily readings of everything. Whereas before, when people didn't have these things, they didn't know. They didn't know what their trend was. If they went and had a bad test at the doctor, I've had that happen and it throws you way off. You just really get depressed. And when I get ready to go to the doctor every 3 months and have those done, I get such anxiety. And you know, you can't have a bad day for testing. So this way I can track myself. So if I do have one bad test, I myself can know that this is just maybe a bad day, and I can let my doctor know also. My daughter, my grandchildren, my son, you know, they're all very supportive. You know, I think sometimes they're maybe in a little bit of denial because, you know, if you look at me, I don't look sick. None of us that have this probably look sick unless we are on oxygen full time. Yes, I have this. I understand what it is now, and I understand that when they say 3 to 5 years, that's an average, but all of us are different with this disease, and it progresses at a different rate. And I've decided I don't really know when my time is. No one does, really. So I just try to make the best of every day and go on. I try not to let it be the main focus of my thinking that I want to have a life. So I'm in a good place.
Glenda Rowland is here with us now. Welcome, Glenda.
Thank you.
And joining us in the conversation is Jessie Lynn Dunn. Jessie Lynn Dunn is a medical researcher who focuses on biosensors, electronic medical records, and wearable devices. She's a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University School of Medicine. Beginning early next year, she will be on the faculty of Duke University's Department of Biomedical Engineering and Department of Biostatistics and Bioinformatics. Jessie Lynn Dunn, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Glenda, that is quite a story you shared. You were diagnosed with IPF 3 years ago. For people who need a reminder, that's idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and it's a type of chronic lung disease with no known cure. Since your diagnosis, how are you doing health-wise today?
I have declined since 2015 somewhat. I'm on oxygen for sleeping at night and for exercise. But I have remained fairly stable in the last year. So in my mind, I'm doing good.
That's great. I mean, you sound spirited.
Well, try to be.
What causes IPF?
Well, in some people, it can be caused by working around asbestos. If you work around things that have dust or sand, it can be hereditary. And if they don't know, other than those things, an autoimmune disease can also cause it. Mine's called idiopathic because they don't know why I got it. And there's a large amount of people that have IPF and none of us know, and our doctors don't know why we have it.
Jessie Lynn, what is your reaction when you hear Glenda's story?
It's really incredible. Glenda's bravery in tackling her disease head on and her determination to become an informed advocate for her own care is really supporting the case for what we as scientists are trying to accomplish. We want our work to directly improve lives of patients. And using the digital health technologies to manage her IPF, Glenda's not only making a difference with her own life and managing her disease, but she also has the potential to help others to learn how to better manage their care and to help scientists and physicians to learn more about IPF through her data.
What can you tell us about her disease?
So IPF is a really challenging disease in that we don't really know what causes it. It's causing a continual decline, and there's really no known treatment. So there are daily challenges in being able to breathe properly and being able to get oxygen to the various organs in the body. So it is incredibly challenging for patients to manage and for physicians to know how to appropriately treat their patients.
And what about the devices that she uses?
So actually, a lot of the devices that Glenda uses are the same devices that we use in our studies. So we don't specifically study IPF, but we study how blood oxygenation changes in different environments. And we look at how lung capacity and lung function changes in those environments. So Glenda uses some fitness tracker device that tracks activity and sleep. She also uses a Bluetooth pulse oximeter. And those are both devices that we use in our studies. She also uses some apps to manage her care. And we don't actually use a lot of those same apps because some of them are specific to IPF. But some are also for broader disease management.
Glenda, you have been, it seems to me, very intrepid through this whole experience. How do you do that? How do you keep it up?
Well, I keep it up because I have a lot of support. I'm on social media with a lot of groups that have IPF, and we encourage each other, and we also talk about the new things that are coming out. We talk about new clinical trials, so we encourage each other, and that's really important when you have a rare disease.
What are you using or wearing right now, technology-wise, in the studio to manage your condition?
Right now in the studio, I'm just wearing my Fitbit Versa, and I'm just, you know, tracking my steps and my heart rate. As long as I'm sitting still, I'm pretty good as far as not having to use a device.
Does it track even if you were to have a spike right now, your heart rate, or if it were to plummet? Would it alert you to that?
Yes, it does. And it tracks my sleep behavior, which is interesting and what I like to know about, because with IPF, your oxygen goes very low at night. So, you know, I like to see when I'm waking up and what time and how many hours of sleep I've gotten. So that's great for me, too.
Jessie-Lynn, I want to ask you for a moment. Was there a specific moment that you can remember that set you on a path to biomedical engineering?
So I've always been very passionate about math and biology. And actually, as a child, when I was about 11, my grandmother underwent a second set of heart valve replacements. She had rheumatic fever as a child, and that damaged her heart valves, which caused her to continuously need these replacements. And I remember when the doctor said that her heart valve would only last about 15 years, being pretty devastated. And so we were incredibly lucky in that my grandmother lived 4 years longer than the doctors expected with her valves. But I found this entire experience incredibly frustrating. I wanted to understand why valves fail, and that drove pretty much the first decade of my research. And then that research led me to a second and potentially more impactful question, which is, can we predict and prevent those valve failures? So I believe that if we can answer this question of predicting and preventing disease, that we can generate better treatments and on a more individualized basis.
Given that people are using wearable technology more, like fitness trackers and smartwatches, there's so much more health data that is available and accessible. How does all that technology change how we administer healthcare?
Technology is enabling us to have something that we call this idea of P4 medicine, which is predictive, preventive, personalized, and participatory. And the ultimate result of those four Ps is having improved healthcare and improved health outcomes, and also patient empowerment. Medicine has been sort of more of a paternalistic field in that the doctor really has agency over the healthcare plan of an individual. But what wearable technology and digital health does is it puts the power back into the hands of the patients, because patients are now able to collect more information about themselves, and they can learn on the internet, for example, about their own conditions and start to bring data to clinic visits. And this way, doctors and patients can work together to come up with healthcare plans that work for this patient on an individual basis.
Do doctors feel threatened by that then if patients are empowered with more knowledge? I mean, if you've been used to your whole career being the one in charge and directing the patient, do this or do that, you know, and now suddenly the patient is coming in and saying, well, I have an alternative way to go about this. I could imagine that some doctors might take umbrage at that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a different model of care. But I think ultimately, when we think about the goal of physicians, their goal is to provide the best possible treatment to their patients. And if that means that taking patients' personal data into consideration and giving patients more agency over developing their healthcare plans is necessary, and that will provide the best health outcomes, then that's their oath to do.
Are there any downsides to all of this, and what are they?
Yeah, so there are some things that we can think about in terms of what type of care plans might be decided upon based on the data. The things that we think about are not providing so much data, one, that the doctors aren't able to make any sort of useful decisions based on that data, two, not suggesting interventions that might not actually be helpful. And then the third is this idea of alarm fatigue. So if the devices are sort of alarming a person, like Glenda mentioned, she can see that her heart rate might be high from her Fitbit. We don't want people to get tired of seeing that. So we do want to make sure that we're delivering notifications in a useful way that doesn't exhaust people.
Almost like a boy who cried wolf, like if you get too many alarms, you won't notice it when actually it means something.
Exactly.
Glenda, you know, the technology that you use is obviously integral to managing your disease. You track your oxygen levels, as you said, and monitor your heart rate, and you generally follow all the metrics in your body. But what did people with IPF use to monitor these different variables before all these apps and devices were around?
Before that, and still even now, you know, a lot of people don't use the apps and the devices available. They rely on the tests at the doctor, and these would be pulmonary function tests. I think that a lot of people don't even ask for those results, but I do, and I track them and I log them into some health apps that I have. So now I ask to take a picture of the computer screen, and they have no problem with me getting my own data that way. Otherwise, I have to ask and I don't get it for a while.
But for people who, you know, that you, who you know who may have this, people from, you know, social media circles and whatnot, who are opting not to use these apps or these trackers, do you have a sense of the reason why they would reject such information?
I don't think a lot of them know about these apps. Also, IPF and pulmonary fibrosis are normally diagnosed later in life, usually over 50. And so we're talking about, you know, an aging population, and some of the people are in their 70s and 80s before they're diagnosed. So I think there might be a lack of understanding of how to use this technology also.
As somebody who uses this machinery, though, you probably see ways in which it can be improved. What are those ways?
Oh, yes. I'm waiting for a tracker, like a fitness tracker, Fitbit, for somebody to come out with one that also reads the oxygen level. They read heart rate, but to read the oxygen level for patients with various types of lung diseases would be so helpful.
Why have they not? Do you have any sense?
I don't. Maybe Jessie Lynn would.
Do you know Jessie Lynn?
Yeah, I can probably weigh in here. On the technological side, it's challenging to read blood oxygen saturation from thicker tissues. And so as you notice, probably when you read your SpO2, you're using either your finger or your earlobe generally. And that's because it's easier to get an accurate signal that way. But there's a lot of work underway, actually, to try to improve upon that technology so that you can gain SpO2 measures from your watch.
Glenda says that a major benefit of the technology she uses is that it reduces her anxiety at the doctor. She can track her progress every day, minute to minute, so there's no scary surprises that might be waiting for her when she gets there. In your research, what are some of the other responses you've heard from patients who use tech to manage their health?
So in general, we see generally positive responses from patients who are using technology to manage their health. One thing we find is that the way that the information is conveyed is incredibly important for how patients are impacted on an emotional level. So exactly as Glenda had mentioned, you can have a bad day for testing, and wearable and mobile technologies enable patients to put a poor test result at a clinic visit into perspective because they have so much more data on themselves to know how their body is really behaving on a regular basis and not just at a single clinic visit that may not represent their day-to-day environment.
Glenda, I'm curious, before you were diagnosed with IPF, were you this interested in your own health, or was this something that came with the diagnosis, really?
I've always been somewhat interested. I'm the kind of person that just wants to know. If I take a drug, I want to know what this drug is, and I want to know what the side effects are and what it does. So, yes, before all this, I probably was, I mean, I'm not obsessed with that, but I like to know, and I like to be in charge of my own body because I know that mistakes can be made, or I want to be a part of my treatment.
Jesse Lynn, tell me, what's one breakthrough technology that you predict will radically change healthcare?
The general person spends about 15 to 20 minutes with a physician each year. Most people's commutes are longer than that time. So the bottom line is that we can't be getting our best care when we're rarely interacting with our own health. And so what I'm most excited about are technologies that allow people's health to be tracked during the other 500,000 plus minutes every year. So we can use a combination of things like telehealth and wearable technology and AI that actually change the paradigm of our traditional health system, which is one checkup per year unless you're sick, so that we can really be tracking everybody every minute of every day. And one of the major goals is to not need a human to oversee the vast majority of those checkups unless something is wrong. And another benefit of this is that we can actually use these technologies in low-resource settings where a lot of people don't get the healthcare that they need because it's too costly or it's highly inconvenient to see a healthcare provider.
But that kind of change that you're talking about wouldn't just change how we get healthcare, how we get treated. It would radically change the entire healthcare industry, wouldn't it?
Yes. And I would say that we know that we're ripe for change just given the cost of healthcare in our country. So it's very well agreed upon that our healthcare paradigm doesn't work. We spend a lot of money treating patients, and that increase in cost does not associate with improved health outcomes. And so it's pretty clear, I think, from the amount of investment that's been going into these new companies in digital health and artificial intelligence and wearable technologies that we're really ripe for a change.
Would you say that's the most exciting thing happening in your field, or are there other developments that you're really super psyched about?
So we've already shown that we can predict infection prior to it occurring. And so that's been work that's been done at Stanford and at Duke. And the goal there is to start telling somebody that they're getting sick before they might even feel symptoms. And so I think those are pretty exciting technologies on the general healthcare side.
That's amazing that you'll be able to predict an infection before it even occurs. Glenda, I want to ask you, what do you see in terms of working as an advocate and an activist in the IPF and rare disease community? Have you specific plans going forward?
I do. In fact, September is Pulmonary Fibrosis Awareness Month through the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation. And I'm doing a couple of TV, just short little appearances. My goal is to make people aware of what this disease is and the early symptoms. It's often misdiagnosed. It could be passed by. So I plan on doing that. I'm meeting with some congressmen to promote the rare disease bills that are out there for more funding and research for rare disease. And I will keep on, doing whatever I can to raise awareness.
Great. Jessie-Lynn, what are you doing that is specifically connected to rare diseases?
So currently I'm not, and actually I want to say that this conversation and meeting Glenda has really inspired me to really dig more into IPF and to learn more about it and to see whether a lot of the technologies that we're working with can help to improve the patient experience, specifically with IPF, because it sounds like a lot of the technologies that I use in my daily studies are the same that Glenda uses. And so if we can design algorithms that can parse the data to determine when somebody is getting influenza, for example, we should be able to do something quite similar for people with IPF to tell them when their symptoms are worsening. And maybe that would help to liberate people like Glenda from spending so much time working on their own data.
Great. That's wonderful. Do either of you have questions that you want to ask one another?
I just want to say to Jessie-Lynn that I'm so happy to hear you say that about IPF. It's such a little known disease that, you know, it's somewhat passed by.
Thanks. And Glenda, you've really taken such agency over your own healthcare. And I would be curious, when you received your diagnosis, did you immediately know that this would be the path that you would take forward? Or was it something that you had to put considerable thought into to decide how much of a role you were going to take in your own healthcare plan?
When I finally resolved myself to what I had, I decided then, after I went through all the trauma of finding out, that I was going to try to help other people understand, because they don't understand when I tell them what I have. When I meet people and I say I have idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, most 9 out of 10 don't know what it is. And they always tell me, you look so great. It's not something that you do see on the outside. And you might look normal if you're not wearing oxygen, you know, 24/7. But they don't see the fatigue. They don't see the other symptoms. They don't see the mental part of it that, you know, I know if I have an exacerbation that I can go to a whole level, another, you know, level pretty quick that would put me maybe needing a lung transplant, because that's the ultimate cure that they have right now. So I guess I'm just a passionate person. And when I found this out and I found that most people don't know what it is, I wanted to help make people aware of what it is.
Glenda, Jessie-Lynn, thank you both so much for this conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Glenda Rowland is a mother, grandmother, businesswoman, and IPF patient living in Birmingham, Alabama. Jessie-Lynn Dunn is a biomedical engineer. And that's it for Season 2 of Life Effects. You can find out more about everything in this series at lifeeffects.teva. Life Effects is a production of Slate Studios in partnership with Teva. I'm Sarah Ivry. Thank you so much for joining us.